This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On 9/11/2001, history marched in on George W. Bush. With wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, George Bush marched on history. Then, with re-election behind him and Iraq turning bloody, the famously stubborn man in the White House went almost silent. Soldiers died, things came undone, hurricanes and scandal soured public life, and President Bush's poll numbers, his public support, plummeted toward the level of the second-term Richard Nixon, the president who resigned. Critics derided Bush as lost in a bubble of sycophants and fixed ideas. Now the president has pushed back with a show of candor and talk of victory. Up next on Point, Bush at the end of a very hard year, in the bubble or breaking out. Joining me now from Washington is David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. David, thanks so much for being with us.
Always good to be with you, Tom.
A path forward with many ifs is your headline today. Do you see President Bush getting back in the saddle here?
Well, this set of four speeches and the 35-page strategy document about Iraq, they represent the first really detailed articulation of a strategy. And, you know, we're 1,000 days into this war, and one of the questions you don't get an answer to from the administration is, why did it take so long to come out with one? The real answer is because the strategy is not directed toward the military or toward their own policymakers. It's basically an articulation of something they've been doing. It's because they felt now that they had to get this out in order to reverse the kind of slide that you described.
We're told that the president has been informed that he has to talk about victory to keep the country on board, and he did a lot of that. He said, we'll have it. It'll be complete. Elections going on there today, and the White House very pleased about that. But that's just the beginning of the hurdles that the president has laid out for himself in defining what victory means, David.
That's right. And when you read the strategy document, what's interesting about it is that they sort of define three levels of victory. One of them they've defined sort of after the fact, and we're sort of already there, that the elections have gone forward, and they have the beginnings of training of the security forces. It's the next level that's really hard, which is, can they get to a point where they have a government that works together? And remember, this election is the easy part. The hard part is getting the Kurds, the Shia, and the Sunnis to all come to enough compromises to put a government together, and that could take months. And can they get the Iraqi forces trained well enough that the president can begin to withdraw American troops without risking one of two calamities? The first one is that the insurgents try to topple this newly elected government, and the second is that the terror groups that are in Iraq use it the way Osama bin Laden used Afghanistan number of years ago, which is basically the launching pad for attacks elsewhere.
He's saying none of those can happen if it's going to be called victory. What is your sense at this point, David, of whether the president's new message is based on real-world confidence or kind of ideological determination, belief?
Well, I think it's a little bit of mix of both in almost everything the president said along the line in Iraq's case. As you noted, he has begun to infuse his speeches with a bit of realism about what's happened in the past. For example, he said that when the U.S. went in initially, they did not properly arm the Iraqi forces so that they could deal with much better armed insurgents and terror groups. He admitted that the reconstruction effort was totally flawed from the beginning with these huge, long-running building mm-hmm. programs for water supply and oil, where Iraqis saw very little immediate improvement in their lives. He acknowledged that on the political front, they started off with a plan that was going to bring elections far too slowly. Now, he argues, look, we changed course along the way. Now, that was interesting because as they were changing course, my recollection of sitting in the White House press room is that they were denying that there were changes taking
yes.
place. But they've now come through and said, yes, that's what we did.
Does that mean we have a president who's now going to speak with more candor right along, or is that too much to hope for?
You know, it's an interesting question. If they have come to a strategic decision that you don't really help your own position by putting on an optimistic face that everything's going well in Washington when people can see on their television sets each night what's going wrong, then we've turned a corner. On the other hand, this is a president who feels, as you said very early on, that Americans will stick with this project as long as they see a victory in the offing, as long as they believe that this is going to, you know, really come together. And I think their concern is that if we end up with 3, 4, 5 months of haggling in Baghdad about the shape of the new government, and meanwhile this new government becomes a huge target for the insurgents, mm-hmm. and it appears to turn into a mess again, that the congressional and public support will erode pretty fast. Mm.
And finally, David, what about the issue of how in touch the president is? We see he's looking for the new groove, as some are calling it. He's also been called trapped in a bubble in recent days. NBC News anchor Brian Williams put it to him directly, said, you know, do you feel in a bubble, essentially, Mr. President? And President
and
Bush
president
said no.
No, he said he talks to real people. He said to Brian, well, you're a real person. Well, Brian is
sort of
a real person, but he may not be a cross-section of America. So the problem that any president faces is that they are obviously sealed off in what President Clinton famously called the crown jewel of the American penal system, the White House. But the question here is he getting his advice from too narrow a group of people who know what answers he wants? And I thought it was interesting that, you know, he gave his first speech in front of a military audience where he knew he would get cheers.
And
he did. His second speech in front of the Council on Foreign Relations, a far more skeptical audience, he took no questions. He took some heat for that. By the time he gave the third speech on Monday, he suddenly took questions. And, you know, my personal view is that you always seem more in touch if you're willing to expose yourself to unrehearsed questions. That's something that the White House has avoided for this president for much of his presidency. And, you know, maybe that decision the other day indicates that they're trying a different tact.
David Sanger at the White House for the New York Times. Wonderful to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Always good to be with you, Tom. Take care.
Thanks, David. We are talking about George Bush at the end of a tough year and where this presidency goes next. Joining me now from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine. She wrote this week about what Bush has been doing to try to reverse his very big second term slump. Karen Tumulty, thanks for being with us.
Well, hi, Tom. Thanks. It's good to be back.
It's great to have you. So here we are, all kinds of charges and lousy polls, and the president stepping up, four speeches and a strategy document of sorts put before the public. You say he's looking for his new groove. Do you feel him finding it?
Well, certainly the poll numbers, as you and David discussed, suggest that, you know, things have improved somewhat. And in fact, last week as we were doing this story, we were being coached by one advisor to the president. Come on, you could be the first one to write the comeback story.
Right. You're not exactly there with your headline.
Right, exactly. They're still in, the poll numbers still in landslide defeat territory here. But the fact is that, you know, this is a time when every White House is planning its State of the Union speech at this time of the year. Mm-hmm. It's always a time of trying to figure out, you know, what exactly is it that you're going to try to accomplish in the next year and in the rest of your presidency. And the White House is very, very aware that this president is running out of time for that turnaround, that very, very soon the focus is going to turn to the midterm elections, and it's going to be harder and harder to get Congress to march in line with his agenda as opposed to their own survival. And that, you know, if these elections don't go very well, that right after that, the attention is going to turn to the people who are running to replace the president. So he knows that there is a relatively short window here, and they are looking at January as a very, very crucial month for kind of getting that momentum going again.
Momentum with the public, it'll be hard for them to bring the Democrats around, but even the president's own party, Republicans, have been complaining lately.
That's right. That's right. So what they really feel that they need to do, obviously, you know, turning things around and getting them on track in Iraq is job number one here. But they are also trying to fashion some sort of domestic agenda of goals that this president could accomplish in the next year that would also make it look like the presidency domestically is back on track.
We're joined in this hour from Washington by Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Her story this week headlined, His Search for a New Groove, and He is the President. And from Washington now, Byron York, White House correspondent for the National Review, author of The Vast Left-Wing Conspiracy. Byron, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
So the president wants to talk, and his people want to talk about a comeback now. How bad has it become? We've seen the poll numbers down around 35%, just a hop, skip, and jump from where Richard Nixon was. From a conservative point of view, how bad was the dark before, well, is it a dawn here?
Well, one, it was pretty bad, but it hasn't been the entire year. It was a year ago that Bush was reelected, and mm-hmm. after earlier Iraqi elections, there was a lot of talk about, is Bush right? I mean, has Bush done the right thing? And during that time, the president devoted almost all of his public energy to promoting Social Security reform.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his conservative supporters, even before Cindy Sheehan made anti-war news in August, were saying, should he really be doing this? Shouldn't he be paying more attention to Iraq? And people at the White House told me, well, we felt like we didn't need to spend any more public rhetorical attention to Iraq. They're certainly spending a lot of time prosecuting the war itself, but they felt they didn't need the president to be talking about it so much because things were going okay for a while. And then it really, really got out of his control after Sheehan and then Hurricane Katrina, and it turned out to be a terrible, terrible fall. Bush heartened his conservative supporters very, very much when he began to do two things. One, he began to push back a little bit at Democrats who were pushing the Bush lied and people died line mm-hmm. by saying that, look, I made my decision based on intelligence, flawed as it was, that other people, including opposition Democrats, had seen. And then the second thing is what he's been doing in these last four speeches is outlining a strategy and stressing the word victory as opposed to withdrawal. The word victory sounds very good to his supporters. Withdrawal doesn't sound very good at all.
And with that, maybe bringing back that support, Karen Tumulty, he's had this Duke political scientist, Peter Feaver, in his circle, apparently whispering in his ear that you've got to talk about victory to keep the public on board. We saw that plastered all over the backdrop of his first speech, and the repeated mention goes on. Is it as simple as that? Is the public that manipulable? Just say the word victory again and again, and you're there?
Well, the fact is that, if you look at most of the polls, most Americans at this moment now consider this war a mistake. But at the same time, most Americans do not want to withdraw. And mm-hmm. I think that the calculation here, and, it probably is a good one, is that as long as people believe that this war is winnable and that this administration has some sort of strategy for doing it, they are not going to support a withdrawal, however large their misgivings about why we're there and the fact that we're there.
I'd like to hear from each of you how you see the circle around George Bush at this point. He's been called the guy in the bubble, maybe is, maybe isn't, but Karl Rove, who was clearly very important to the president, has had his own problems in the Valerie Plame investigation, been on the defensive. Dick Cheney had his chief of staff, Scooter Libby, indicted. First to you, Byron York, what about the president's inner circle, who he's leaning on? Is he in touch? Does he have the support that he needs? Cheney and Rove, what's their role now?
Well, I think their role is still very critical. Bush did an interview with Fox News, I believe, yesterday, and reaffirmed his support for Cheney, saying that he's still very close, very trusted, very discreet, which is extremely important to Bush. Karl Rove remains extremely important and will be unless he's indicted, in which case he'll be out. But I think that if he is not charged in the CIA leak investigation, you'll see him stay. So, there's been a lot of advice from Bush from Democrats and also some Republicans that he needs some sort of shakeup in his inner circle. Bush people will tell you that, look, we've had a fair amount of change. The staff has changed over time, but the big players have not, and Bush has expressed a lot of confidence in Cheney, Rumsfeld, and Rove.
Karen Tumulty, how do you see it? How do you report it? The same intimacy, the same confidence with that inner circle?
Well, what our sources are telling us, and that we reported in the magazine this week, is that, yes, the president has absolutely, he bristles at this idea that some sort of major house cleaning is in order here, the way, Ronald Reagan did after Iran-Contra. However, there have been some shifts within the inner circle. Dick Cheney is not, who once was, famous for his workaholic hours, is not being seen nearly as much in the West Wing these days. As one of his confidants told us, he's working hours more in keeping with his age, his station, and his health. He's spending a lot more time in the vice president's mansion and at his new vacation home on the Eastern Shore. Karl Rove, although he is now back and working on this agenda for 2006, comes away from the scandal from the leak investigation. He has escaped, at least in the first round, an indictment, but he's feeling very bruised. And people who once would tell you Karl Rove is going to be here till the end of this term no longer dismiss the idea that perhaps at some point he's going to decide to go do something else. So the circle itself has sort of the dynamics within the circle have changed somewhat over the past year.
Whether they're looking abroad or looking at home. Byron, I know we've only got you for another minute. Let me ask you, with a president who clearly has been wounded late in this year, trying to come back now, Republicans looking at midterm elections, the idea of a kind of 50-year Republican reign looking a lot wobblier than it did a year ago. What's the range of GOP views that you see now on their opportunities with this president? What sort of best case, worst case scenario for the year ahead for the GOP?
Well, in some sense, they're kind of locked in the trunk of Bush's car, and, you know, they'll see how Iraq goes. But, before August, Republicans were very confident of holding both houses of Congress in 2006. After August, after Katrina, after Iraq got worse, after gas prices went up, you saw a lot less confidence. Right now you're seeing a little bit more because structurally it's going to be just difficult for Democrats to take over. On the other hand, approval levels of Congress are not as bad as they were in late 1994 before the huge Republican takeover, but they're getting into that territory. So there is a fair amount of Republican skittishness. As far as Bush's ratings are concerned, the White House will tell you, Ronald Reagan hit 35% in 1983, was reelected later. Bill Clinton hit 39% in 1994, was reelected later. Those were not second-term ratings, but still they're pretty low. So they will suggest that there are indeed recovery scenarios out there.
And hoping and praying right now, Byron York with the National Review. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Joe's calling from Rutland, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
We're good. What do you think, Joe?
Well, it's funny. I've taken a sentence from a gentleman that I so obviously voted against. I think there are two Americas. And I think a lot of the times the America that's represented by the inside the Beltway, Washington, and the high-end newspapers and things like that are very concentrated on the issues and how they're not so much how the issues are resolved, but more so how the issues play to Americans. The other America is those of us who are sort of tooling around every day doing our thing, hoping that we're getting the information we need. But at the same time, we pretty much are pretty resolved to the fact that on September 12th or the 14th of 2001, when the president stood on that pile of rubble, we were all standing with him, whether we were Democrats or Republicans. And it's hard to sort of say 35% to 45%, what she should be at 65%. I think we're all losing a little bit of focus. Not all of us, but I think some of us are losing some of the focus.
But those poll numbers, Joe, those aren't just, high-tier parlors or just factory floors. That's right across the country, and down at 35%, that's 6 points away from Nixon's.
I suppose so, but I have to also say that, I not to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but anyone who's looking at polling, I've never been called for a poll, and I think the majority of people have never been called for a poll. I think it's sometimes hard to remember that. America is made up of patriots, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, and to judge the president, a difficult year. This wasn't a difficult year. This was a tremendously difficult year.
No kidding.
And I think he had amazing poise during the year. I don't support everything he does or everything he says, but I have to say that I support the president, and I think he did a remarkable job in a difficult year.
You're a generous man. I mean, it was difficult in part because we saw some failure of execution, failure that the president himself is now conceding. But Karen Tumulty, and thanks for your call, Joe. Karen Tumulty, let me put it to you. When the numbers get down, as they did very recently, to 35%, that means even some significant portion of what the president has seen as his rock-solid base is not giving him the nod.
It does. And those numbers, don't forget that. Those numbers measure job approval. How well do you think he's doing? If you look at the public's measures of George Bush as a man and of his character and of his leadership, those numbers have also plummeted in the last year. And in many, many ways, That's even more worrisome to the White House because, of course, much of the Bush presidency and much of his reelection was based on his strengths as a leader and his resolve. And when, you know, the public confidence in that begins to be shaken, you know, that in some ways is harder to regain than these job approval numbers.
Mm. Karen, I want to get some historical perspective here, if we may. We're joined now from Washington by Robert Dalek. He's a presidential historian. He's written biographies and history on John F. Kennedy, on Lyndon Johnson, on Ronald Reagan, on FDR. Is a work on a forthcoming book about Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger. Robert Dalek, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Put this president's showing over the last year, 6 months, if you will, into a kind of a historical context. We look at these numbers where he's dipped close to Nixon, not so long before Nixon resigned from office, and it looks like, oh my gosh, what do you make of the president's poll numbers, his first year of a second term in historical terms?
Yeah, well, it's he's doing unusually poorly. He's been unlucky, of course, in the sense that he had to struggle against this Katrina difficulty. But, of course, the war in Iraq was very much of his own making, and I think it really is the Iraq war which is dogging him so much now. And it has certain similarities to what happened to Harry Truman and what happened to Lyndon Johnson, both of whom were leading the country in essentially second terms in time of war. And Truman's war in Korea became horribly unpopular and drove his numbers down at the end of his presidential term to about 32-33%. Lyndon Johnson could barely go out in the street or couldn't go around the country campaigning anymore. Eugene McCarthy, of course, stepped in and won 42% of the vote in New Hampshire in March of 1968. And then Bobby Kennedy jumped into the race, and Johnson had to essentially concede that he couldn't run and win again. So I think there are similarities here. Also, what I find most interesting is these speeches that Bush has been making lately. And I think the rhetoric, the content of them, they're pretty well done. They're well-drawn speeches. But I think what the White House is missing is that what really counts with the public is not this kind of rhetoric, because Truman and Johnson, they also spoke out in behalf of commitment to the war. Richard Nixon as well, during his first term, as that war in Vietnam continued, his numbers were became somewhat shaky. Now, of course, what served Nixon was he began pulling the troops out, and he ended the draft, so that by the time his 72 election came around, there were only about 29,000 American troops left, and the number had been 545,000 when he came to office. So I think Bush's fate is now very much tied up with what happens in Iraq.
Karen Timothy, President Bush talks very ambitiously about transforming the world, or a big chunk of it. Do you see any evidence that the president is questioning that big, almost messianic vision?
None at all. And in fact, if you look at his reading lately, this mention of Harry Truman yesterday was no accident. The president lately has been reading a lot of history, and it's a lot of history about wartime presidents, and primarily because he finds comfort in the fact that there were presidents like Harry Truman, who were, you know, widely denounced during their own time and questioned by people who, their own contemporaries, but ultimately were redeemed by history. I think that this president continues to have a very strong faith that he, too, will be redeemed by history, whatever difficulties he's going through
and
now.
And can he not take some sense of justification in that feeling in the elections today?
Well, it's certainly, you know, they do seem to have gone fairly well so far. But it's, you know, there's also a question of what kind of government emerges from this, and also, you know, how well equipped they are, in fact, going to be to take over the management of their own country. So, yes, these elections do appear to have been a success.
Robert Dalek, how about it? Here we are, 3 years to go. You've seen the path the president is beginning to tread here. do you see enough support? Do you see enough of a case being made that he can hang on, be effective governing in a very difficult time that really matters to this country and the world?
Absolutely, it matters. And, of course, it is a burden for him, and it's a burden for the country, so to speak. We're all in this together. But, again, I come back to my point, a losing war, so to speak, a war at which the country has no considerable patience with, is a burden that a president, at least history tells us, cannot overcome. Now, it may well be that he's going to begin pulling troops out, that by a year from now we find that lots of American troops have left. And even if there is considerable instability in Iraq, I don't know that the American public will care all that much.
So that might be one way around it. Our time's coming very quickly to a close. Karen Tumulty, do you see President Bush back in fighting form? Do you see him, going to be back on the hustings with the new year, out there, keep punching?
I think he will be, and I think it's because he has no choice.
You know, 3 years to go, he's got to make his case. Karen Tumulty with Time Magazine, national political correspondent there. Wonderful to have you. Thanks very much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Robert Dalek, presidential historian, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.